Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. With the first presidential debate less than a week away, two Republican senators have released a report about Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, who President Trump is expected to attack for his role on the board of Ukrainian energy company Burisma. You remember Hunter Biden held that high-paying position at a time when then-Vice President Joe Biden was tasked with fighting corruption in Ukraine. But the report from Senators Chuck Grassley and Ron Johnson concludes the extent to which Hunter Biden's role on Burisma's board affected U.S. policy toward Ukraine is not clear. For more, let's bring in Karen Demirjian, national security reporter for The Washington Post. And Karen, Democrats say this investigation was nothing more than payback for the impeachment inquiry into whether President Trump had a quid pro quo with Ukraine, military aid in exchange for dirt on the Bidens. How would you characterize the report's conclusions?
Well, look, the Republicans' conclusion is kind of pulling up a whole lot of things that we've already heard publicly. There's very little in this report that is a new charge about the specter of Hunter Biden having this role while his dad was the VP looking bad. But it doesn't really connect the dots back to anything that can be classified as proven wrongdoing by Joe Biden. And so it kind of hasn't ended with all of that much, given how much time that they have spent investigating this. But now all of this is on paper, and so this will be fodder and fuel for people who wanted to criticize the former vice president and kind of shake this chain again as we're heading into the heat of the election season and a debate next week. So I'm sure you will see certain people raise it, although there's very little that we haven't already discussed here that's in these pages.
Well, yeah, just someone saying a report on Hunter Biden reminds people of the issue. But to be clear, is there anything in the report's finding that concludes, as many of President Trump's supporters did, that Hunter Biden was being paid a lot of money to keep Joe Biden from fighting corruption in Ukraine?
There's nothing here that shows that Hunter Biden's role affected the way that Joe Biden fought corruption in Ukraine. There is open questions about whether it was appropriate for Hunter Biden to have that role. The report certainly quotes a number of officials who were close to Biden who raised concerns about this and concerns that Russian actors would exploit this to try to undermine the message that the United States was trying to get across in Ukraine, the anti-corruption message. But that's as far as it goes. It doesn't actually pin any wrongdoing or pin any changes in policy on the Obama administration or on Biden himself as a result of the fact that his son had this job.
There have been charges that Russian agents were feeding documents to Grassley and Johnson, the Republican senators. They've denied this. Do we know any more?
Well, I mean, this has been one of the most controversial points of the campaign, right? Because you do have Kremlin-connected actors, included one who was sanctioned earlier this month by the Treasury Department as an active Russian agent, who have been peddling similar lines of argument publicly and saying that they have been pushing documents and other materials to Johnson and Grassley. Now, Johnson and Grassley have vehemently denied this over and over and over again. The only Ukrainian national that they say they've had any contacts with is Andriy Telyashenko, who is this former diplomat who once was a consultant for a lobbying firm that lobbied on behalf of the company that Hunter Biden was on the board of, which it becomes a big contorted mess in that part. And of course, you know, Johnson and Grassley's argument has been, look, we have vetted everything that we, you know, saw, and we didn't get anything directly from the guy who was sanctioned, and we would support the sanctions against him. So this has been an uglier side of the fight. As Democrats try to put this in the greater context of the stakes of what this means geopolitically and in terms of, you know, potential foreign election interference. And Republicans have stuck very hard to the line of, we didn't talk to those individual people, so how can you accuse us of this?
Yeah. Meanwhile, there are reports from the CIA and the FBI that Vladimir Putin plans to release information denigrating Biden. We know there are unverified transcripts of Biden and former Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko circulating. Do we have any sense what they say, how credible they are, what this information denigrating Biden might be?
Right. Those tapes have been circulating for a while and have been peddled by the two Ukrainian individuals I mentioned, Derkach, who's the one who's been sanctioned, the one who Democrats accuse is kind of, you know, behind this full Russian disinformation effort, and Telyashenko, the former diplomat who the Republicans acknowledge they've had contact with. They've both been peddling these unverified, seemingly heavily edited transcripts of these recorded conversations between Biden and Poroshenko. And look, the recent revelations that Putin is pushing this, really nothing that's Kremlin orchestrated happens without Putin's blessing. And so it's a natural extension that this would be a Putin orchestrated sort of campaign. So that illustrates the level to which this has risen and the seriousness of that. And it illustrates also how, you know, the Ukraine narrative and the collusion allegations that have been floating out there, frankly, since late in the 2016 election are rearing their head again now in this new form. And of course, the focus of this investigation is Hunter Biden, but it's kind of this continuum of the same, seemingly the same actors, seemingly the same Kremlin hand behind things, advancing this counter narrative to the arguments that Democrats have been making both about Russian interference and about Trump's own culpability in putting out this line that, no, the bigger concern is Ukraine and the Bidens and everything that's affiliated with that.
That's Karen Demirjian, national security reporter for The Washington Post. Karen, thank you.
Thank you.
While as states gear up for this fall's elections, many are looking at ways to keep the voting process secure from hackers, malware, and disinformation. One way they're doing that is by calling in the National Guard to provide cybersecurity expertise. From Denver, Megan Verley prepared this report for the American Homefront Project.
We want to encourage folks to be able to exercise their right to vote. It is safe, it is secure, and it's something that that we are protecting.
On the morning of this summer's Colorado primary, Denver County Clerk Paul Lopez stood in front of a mobile voting center to praise the lengths his office was going to keep voters safe from COVID-19.
Also, you know, all of our election judges, our elections personnel are wearing masks. They're sanitizing our stations.
But literal viruses aren't the only ones election officials have to worry about. Behind the scenes, efforts are underway to make sure the computer systems elections rely on aren't compromised by bad actors. A recent Senate intelligence report laid bare Russia's efforts to influence the 2016 election for President Trump. Colorado Secretary of State Jenna Griswold says they're likely to try to interfere again.
When we are in the COVID-19 crisis, there is a tendency to drop the ball on the fact that Russia is actively trying to undermine our democracy. And our partnership with the National Guard is just one of many things we do to make sure that Coloradans can have confidence in our election results.
Colorado started working with the National Guard on election cybersecurity around 7 years ago, as it was moving to a statewide electronic poll book and all-mail ballots. This year's team is made up of a half dozen Guard members, including Captain Reese Watkins.
I'm the Cyber Network Defense Manager for the Cyber Protection Team 174.
Watkins is a programmer in his daily life. Others on the team work in corporate security and similar fields. He says they're used to operating in the private sector, as well as the heavily protected systems used by the military.
Almost every single person on my team has a day-to-day job that we do this full-time. So it helps us stay in the current workforce and know exactly what's happening in real life.
In general, the team's job isn't to fight threats, just to find them. That can be anything from someone spreading misinformation on social media to direct attacks on the state's crucial voter registration database. What they spot, they pass on to Colorado's own IT professionals to address. Captain Watkins says their real strength is as a set of fresh eyes searching for vulnerabilities.
When you're looking at your home, right, you don't see very many things that are wrong until someone comes over and visits and they see something wrong with your house. You're like, wow, that your window is broken. And you go, oh my gosh, I didn't even notice that. So that's kind of what we're there to do, is just be another set of eyes.
This year, more than 30 U.S. states have some sort of IT partnership with their National Guard to provide election support. Colonel George Haynes is the chief of cyber operations at the National Guard Bureau in Washington, D.C. He says states and federal security agencies in general have been doing more to collaborate on cybersecurity since the last presidential election.
We have seen a increase in partnership, an increase in information sharing, an increase in working together through tabletop exercises, through sharing of tactics, techniques, and procedures.
But it doesn't sit well with everyone.
When the military runs elections in other countries, it's considered that those countries have a military dictatorship.
That's John Lindback. He spent 8 years as Oregon's election director and then volunteered overseas as an election observer. He says if civilian election officials feel they absolutely must have the National Guard's help, they should at least be completely transparent about it with the public.
Who from the National Guard is helping you? Exactly what are they doing in regards to cybersecurity? And what kind of access have you given them to state and local technology?
The National Association of State Election Directors actually had a panel on partnering with the National Guard at its meeting earlier this year. And Lindbeck says he was alarmed not to see more people reacting with concern.
I mean, nobody at that meeting said anything, not one word about, well, you know, there could be a potential public perception problem here. What about transparency? Wouldn't that be good?
And the Guard's role in elections may be getting bigger this year. While the cybersecurity partnerships have been developing for a while, this fall could also see boots-on-the-ground operations. The Guard has said it is ready, if needed, to help with the physical challenges of conducting elections during a pandemic. For Here and Now, I'm Megan Verlee in Denver.
The presidential election has begun, literally. More than 64 million absentee ballots have already been requested or sent to voters in 30 states and the District of Columbia, which means people are casting their ballots as we speak. We wanted to take a look at how this factors into the ground game for presidential candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump. How are they campaigning in key states during this pandemic in order to solidify their support and win over those elusive undecided voters? For this conversation, we have with us Republican strategist Matt Mikowiak and Democratic strategist Jamal Simmons. Welcome to you both.
Hi, good to be here.
Hey.
So how does this evolving election day, where ballots are literally being filled out right now, play into the way these candidates are campaigning, where money is actually being spent, where they choose to visit, and in what order they make those visits? And I'll start with you, Matt.
Yeah, it's interesting because you're going to see a larger share of the overall vote cast ballots by mail this cycle than we've ever seen. And I think at a minimum, that's going to be more people choosing to vote by absentee who are eligible to do so. And then in some states where mail ballots are being sent out, even if they're not requested, you're going to see even a higher share of the votes being cast by mail. Look, it obviously moves up. I think Jamal would agree with this. It moves up, the beginning of the get out the vote, you know, period of the race. You know, normally that might begin maybe 96 hours or 72 hours before election day. But if mail ballots are already being cast in some of these states, you're getting to a point where persuasion is not going to be as valuable, and it's about turning out people you've identified. I think data is a big part of this too. The campaigns that have the best data are going to be taking people out who have cast their ballot. They're not wasting time communicating, knocking on their door, calling them, mailing them. They can really become far more efficient as people turn their mail ballots in. So we're in a little bit uncharted territory because it's going to be a higher share of the overall vote than it's ever been.
Sure. Jamal, you know, when President Trump visited Arizona last week, some voters noted that Joe Biden had yet to visit the state. This month, Joe Biden himself has physically touched down in about 13 places, as opposed to President Trump, who made about 17 campaign stops this month. Some are saying Biden is running a more sophisticated campaign, but do you think that he could be underestimating how much voters like to see their candidates in person, or at least visiting their states in spite of the pandemic?
You know, the Democrats are far out on the ice right now, and nobody knows where the soft spots are. The problem is the pandemic. And so normally this time of year, every 4 years, we're all in, you know, all those states that are getting the pumpkin patches ready out in Michigan and Wisconsin and Ohio, you know, doing the campaigning. But you can't do that this year because the virus is happening. And the thing that's different about Democrats than Republicans is that Democrats actually believe the science. And so they don't want to go to super spreader events where they're going to be cheek to jowl with a bunch of people they've never met before in their lives, breathing on each other without masks on.
But
the Republicans
but
seem
point,
to be okay with
yeah.
that.
Well, to your point, though, there, I mean, we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but Trump's strategy has been stopping at airports and having these rallies where he's not up against people, but he does show his face in particular states. So how does this sophisticated campaign from Biden's camp, which is focused on the pandemic and social distancing, speak to those who are undecided and exhausted by months of pandemic restrictions?
Yeah, Donald Trump's not up against the people, but the people are up against each other. And so this is what I'm getting at. Democrats and the people who are more likely to vote for Joe Biden are people who believe the scientists who say you should not be doing that.
You know, I'm thinking about the way that appearances are made from the candidates. As I mentioned, Trump is stopping at a lot of places, but these are airport visits. Let's take a look at just this week. For the last two nights in a row, Trump has held outdoor rallies at airport hangars to get around coronavirus rules, where he speaks without a mask to a pumped up crowd. In Pittsburgh last night, he spoke for nearly 2 hours. Let's listen.
We will make America strong again. We will make America proud again. We will make America safe again. And we will make America great again. Thank you. Thank you, Pennsylvania. Thank you.
So, yeah, I mean, the airport hangar visit, I think, has a couple benefits to it. One, it limits the amount of time that you're on the ground and allows you to do more activity, right? If you're not having to get in a motorcade, drive to a location, do the activity there, then drive back. I mean, you're cutting 30 minutes to an hour in drive time. But the second thing I think that's important is that these are large venues. They are, I don't know if you'd call them open air. It kind of depends if they're covered or not. But some hangars have roofs and some don't. Either way, it's a little bit safer than being in an arena or in a, you know, high school gymnasium that's entirely enclosed. But you're right. I mean, there's a difference between the campaign Trump's running and the campaign Biden's running. The Biden campaign has specifically said that they don't believe door knocking is something that they want to be doing. And if you look at the Trump campaign and the RNC, I forget the number of doors they've knocked, but it's tens of millions this election cycle. And so we're going to see whether that makes a difference. I think it will. The Biden campaign is outspending Trump on television, but the Trump campaign is outworking Biden's campaign on the ground.
In many of those key states, like Wisconsin, for instance, Biden leads with 48 percentage points, according to the most recent Reuters Ipsos poll. Are those stops really going to help in his effort to try to get voters who are undecided, or are they really just to rally his base?
Yeah, I think they're probably more focused on the base, to be honest with you. Of course, the issue set that's in front of the voter is going to affect undecided voters. We've seen the introduction of the Supreme Court as an intense and urgent issue just since Friday, which is going to, I think, re-scramble this race a bit. You know, you have a lot of ways to reach undecided voters. Going to an airport hangar, in a battleground state is not one of them. You're using digital ads. You're hopefully using television. You're using direct contact through phones and doors. You're using mail. So there's a lot of ways that they can move people. I know the Trump campaign believes in these rallies, and it's not just because Trump likes doing them. It's because they say, based on the data they collect, that around 20% of the people who attend the rallies are generally Democratic voters historically.
Really?
I know that's probably hard for Jamal to believe, but if that's true, I mean that could be a huge difference maker in these battleground states where the margin's so close.
Well, Trump will be in Charlotte, North Carolina tomorrow, his fifth visit. What's his message there? And will he even bring up health care, which is a big issue there? His next Supreme Court may strike down Obamacare. He's expected as soon as tomorrow to roll out an executive order that somehow protects coverage of pre-existing health conditions, which, of course, is what the Affordable Care Act does. Is he winning or losing support there because of it?
Are you asking, is he winning or losing support based on healthcare?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, look, healthcare has traditionally been an issue where Democrats have an advantage. And they used that advantage to their own benefit in 2018 when in suburban congressional districts they ran on the pre-existing condition issue. I don't think the court's going to strike it down, certainly not entirely. It may have a partial ruling. It may get sent down to lower courts. And even if it did get struck down, there is a bipartisan consensus that they want to protect pre-existing conditions in whatever would replace Obamacare. But no, that's not really an issue where they can go on offense. I do think he may talk about things like Medicare for All, which are really expensive and would end the private health insurance coverage that people have. But the opportunity for Trump is to go on offense on issues like the economy, on the Supreme Court, and then on crime in our cities and what he would do to help protect people. Those are the issues where he has the advantage, particularly on the economy. He's got a significant advantage over Biden. The more he talks about the economy, the better he'll do.
Jamal, I want you to weigh in here on this.
Yeah, you know, in general, I think what's happening right now is Matt has gotten the technicalities right. People are really doing turnout right now more than they're doing a lot of persuasion. I have a friend who is focused on this campaign every day, and his belief is, and his organization, is that anybody who's still undecided is probably a Trump voter because it's so hard to be undecided about Donald Trump at this point. You've got all the information that you need to know. So the question is, you know, but Joe Biden, luckily, is polling at around 49, 50, 52% in a lot of the states where he needs to win. So they've just got to turn their voters out. And as I was saying before, the tough part for Democrats is Democrats are flying with one eye closed because you can't. Democratic voters are more likely to believe the science, and so they don't want to be face to face with a lot of strange people. And so you can't really do the same door knocking that the Republicans can do, or the big rallies that Republicans can do. And so they've got to do it in a more digital way through text messages, emails, phone calls.
What are you both watching closely, strategy wise, in the coming weeks? With the short amount of time I have with you, I'll start with you, Jamal.
Oh, I'm certainly watching this turnout. Obviously, the Supreme Court conversation is going to be a big one on the Democratic side. But getting it back to the question of the virus and who can handle the crises that we have is the ground that Joe Biden needs to be on. Of course, the biggest thing are going to be the debates.
And Matt?
Yeah, Tuesday's debate, I think, is going to be consequential. Perhaps the most important presidential debate since 1980. You know, Biden has to prove that he's up to this, that he's able to handle tough questions, that he's able to stand on his own record and take the incoming from Trump. And Trump's got to continue to demonstrate that this is a choice election and that he is worthy of a second term.
That's Republican strategist Matt Mokowiak and Democratic strategist Jamal Simmons. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
A group of black doctors have formed an expert task force to independently vet coronavirus vaccines and guidance from the CDC and FDA. Historically, black communities have been distrustful of medical trials, given a long history of mistreatment and exclusion. Members of this task force felt that the coronavirus guidance from federal health agencies was being influenced by politicians and now plans to serve as a review panel to recommend or discourage such guidance to its members. Eric Budman recently wrote about this. He's a reporter with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. And Eric, will this group actually have access to the pertinent information they'll need?
So after I wrote this article, I did speak with someone who is both on the National Medical Association's task force and is part of a working group at the CDC. And he said it's not as though he'll be giving the task force early looks at data, but rather the CDC and FDA have to be saying something publicly in order for the task force to have something to review.
Okay. So they'll be reviewing publicly available information.
Yes.
The hesitation of some black Americans in taking a new vaccine is not surprising, as I mentioned, given the long history of mistreatment by the medical system. But you give an even more modern day example, like the push for the use of hydroxychloroquine to fight COVID-19. How does the task force plan to address that?
So in terms of vaccine hesitancy, I think the task force really sees itself as a way to increase vaccine uptake in the black community. And their hope is that everything will look good from a scientific standpoint that's coming out of the FDA, and then they'll be able to turn to their membership and say, we think this looks great, and we encourage you to encourage your patients to get this vaccine, and thus immunization rates will be higher than they might be if there weren't that kind of encouragement. Of course, what happens if there is a disagreement between the FDA's decision and the task force is sort of up in the air.
Yeah, that brings to mind then, is there a possibility that those efforts could backfire and so deeper distrust?
I think there is that possibility, but also, as you mentioned, with the emergency use authorization for hydroxychloroquine, it really would have been warranted for a task force to say, members, do not prescribe this for your COVID-19 patients. And so I can see how it might deepen distrust, but also how there might be situations in which that's warranted.
If the task force is independently vetting this information and guidance, are there concerns that there could be further confusion about a vaccine if the task force and federal agencies have different conclusions, as you kind of alluded to earlier. I mean, that is a big concern, I would guess.
Already there's sort of an environment of confusion, and I think the task force would say we're hoping to dispel some of that confusion, but I think that is always a risk with different messages coming from different groups.
A lot to watch for here as the race is on for a vaccine. Eric Budman is a reporter for our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you so much, Tanya.
Orange skies, homes in flames in the west, flooded streets, battered homes in the south. It's climate change we can see, warming waters and drought, fuel fires and hurricanes. Today, what we can't often see, but doctors are calling a full-blown public health crisis, a story that's part of our Covering Climate Now, a week-long global journalism collaboration. Dr. Neelu Tummala practices medicine at George Washington University Hospital. Dr. Tummala, start by telling us about a grandmother you treated who was caring for her infant grandchild.
So this grandmother that I saw during one of the July heat waves, she's another face of the climate crisis. She came in, she was late, she seemed very flustered, and she said they don't have air conditioning at their house, and she said that it was just too hot, so she decided to go to the train station to walk around this inside of the train station until it closed just to be able to keep her grandchild cool because she was concerned about the child overheating.
And is that a real concern? Can you, in your bed in an apartment, can a child get dehydrated or overheat?
Yeah, so the impacts of heat on our health are very wide. You know, heat is one of the deadliest natural disasters. And the last 10 years are the hottest decade on record, and these extended periods of heat exposure can compromise the body's ability to regulate temperature. They can lead to heat cramps, heat exhaustion, heat stroke, and even death. And a lot of times these temperature extremes can worsen chronic conditions, including cardiovascular and respiratory conditions. Impacts of heat on children starts at the prenatal level with premature birth rates and increased pregnancy complications. And then as children get older and become more active, their bodies produce heat faster than adults do, but they can't get rid of it as quickly because they don't sweat as much as adults. And a lot of times they also cannot communicate what they're feeling. So for example, dizziness and nausea may be signs of heat exhaustion, but if your child is not able to communicate that well, it can be a challenging situation.
Well, and then if they're an infant, they can't communicate it that well. And we know how hot it is. I mean, July 2019, as you write in a recent piece in Scientific American, was the hottest July on record. September 2019, the hottest on record. January 2020, the hottest January on record. May 2020, the hottest on record. You say this is no coincidence. It's a pattern. It's from greenhouse gases contributing to global warming. And I'm thinking that's here in the United States. You have a grandmother walking around a train station trying to cool off an infant in the middle of the night. How are you hearing from other doctors around the world? What is happening to children around the world?
Right. Many of the countries that contribute least to global warming run the risk of being the most affected. So rural villages that tend to rely on local water supplies and agricultural lands are being heavily affected. This year, between 75 and 250 million people on the continent of Africa are projected to be exposed to increased water stress due to climate change, and global warming of 2 degrees Celsius would put over 50% of the continent's population at risk of undernourishment.
Well, let's stay global. And I'm sure this is an issue in the U.S. as well, but what about waterborne illness because of climate change?
Right. So worldwide, you know, factors like flooding, which is associated with higher sea levels, and intensified hurricanes, which are often powered by the impacts of climate change. I mean, we're dealing with this right now here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. These are contributing to a more moist environment, which allows things like mold to grow more readily in households. You know, molds are associated with worsening allergy symptoms and can be a cause of asthma attacks. And the climate crisis is also an issue of climate justice. And so people who live in cramped apartments or where the housing infrastructure does not allow adequate protection from moisture, they're definitely more susceptible to the health impacts of these waterborne illnesses.
This can happen in rural areas as well where you get flooding. It promotes algae, bacteria, toxic agents in the water. And you remind us of how this happened here in the United States. Humans are being affected by this around the world, but here in the U.S., dogs were.
Definitely, yeah. So climate change is transforming the aquatic ecosystems. So as coastal waters experience progressive warming, which includes acidification and deoxygenation, harmful algae blooms are appearing. So I believe it was last year when dog owners in some parts of the country were warned to keep their pets out of the waters after some dogs died due to swimming in these contaminated waters, which is terrible.
Yeah, well, you know, so are little children, you know, going into the contaminated waters. It's like you're really reminding us. We think we know about air and climate change, that, you know, maybe there's more pollen in the air. It's harder to breathe for people who have compromised immune systems or asthma. How much is air quality being impacted by climate change?
So it's an interesting time to talk about air quality, obviously, with the wildfires on the West Coast. And I'm based in Washington, D.C., and, you know, there's been recent evidence that some of the wildfire smoke from the West Coast has made its way to D.C. One of the things that's really challenging with poor air quality is that it affects so many parts of our bodies. It can affect lung growth, and it can also affect people who have chronic obstructive pulmonary diseases, such as asthma. It can affect cardiovascular health, leading to an increased risk of heart disease. It can increase your risk of stroke. But it's also now increasingly being linked to premature birth rates and cognitive dysfunction. But one of the concerns with the climate crisis is because you can't see it, people tend to be less likely to act on it. And that's why we haven't seen as much aggressive action on the climate crisis as it needs.
What about vector-borne diseases, you know, insects, mosquitoes, fleas, and ticks? We can only imagine what happens when things get warmer and you see more of them.
Right, whether it's malaria, dengue, Lyme disease, or West Nile virus. So Lyme disease is the most common tick-borne disease here in North America. So the tick responsible for Lyme disease is highly dependent on climate patterns, and the geographic range of the tick vector has expanded westward from the northeast United States as well as southward year after year.
What about mental health? We spoke last year with a psychiatrist who was traveling internationally and locally, running programs for kids traumatized by climate-related events. Can't imagine some of the apocalyptic images we've seen, Australia's fires, our own fires here, flooding around the world. How is climate change affecting mental health that you see?
So, you know, this is really challenging. I actually have a colleague on the West Coast who was telling me that during the wildfires, she has a 2-year-old daughter, and she had to make the decision between keeping the windows open to keep the 94-degree temperature in her daughter's room cool versus closing the window to be able to protect her daughter from the wildfire smoke. And, you know, just sort of thinking about the anxiety and stress of a mom trying to make that decision, respiratory health versus risking heat stress. And, you know, the impacts of heat on like depression, anxiety, suicidal tendencies, these are all really well documented. As we see these increasing intensities of natural disasters, a lot of mental health providers are seeing increased rates of post-traumatic stress disorder. And one of the other things I think that's being increasingly talked about also is eco-anxiety. People are very concerned about what does that mean for future generations? What does that mean for our planet? What does that mean for the future?
Well, you have set up a frightening scenario. Dr. Neela Tumala of George Washington University Hospital, her recent article in Scientific American is What Climate Change Does to the Human Body. We'll link it hereandnow.org. Dr. Tumala, Neelu, thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin. And the one thing I want to say that I didn't mention is vote. Voting this November is so important. Voting for people who prioritize green policy is really important. The climate crisis is a public health crisis, and it demands our collective climate action.
Okay. Well, a moment now to remember football icon Gale Sayers, the Kansas Comet. He played just 7 seasons, all with the Chicago Bears, but was called one of the best running backs of all time, setting a league record in 1965 in his first season with 22 touchdowns, going All-Pro 5 times before retiring in 71. Here he is in a 2010 NFL documentary.
Give me 18 inches of daylight. That's all I need.
I never went on a practice field and worked on faking left, going right, or turning around, that type of thing. Many times there'd be a fellow coming from my blind side, And no way I could see, but I could feel it.
Well, today, Hall of Fame President David Baker called this Hall of Famer, the youngest ever inducted, the very essence of a team player. An understatement. Sayers, who is black, roomed with white teammate Brian Piccolo when hotel rooms were still segregated. That made news. Then Piccolo was diagnosed with cancer and died. Their deep friendship inspired the lovely TV movie Brian's Song with this Henry Mancini theme. Gail Sayers was just 77.
Earlier this month, a photo showing the realities of internet access went viral. It was of two little girls sitting outside of a Taco Bell using the free Wi-Fi to do their homework. The image underscored the digital and economic divide in this country. Up to 16 million K-12 students lack adequate internet connection for remote learning. And there's evidence that class attendance is already down this year. Teachers from the Salinas City Elementary School District recognized the girls as their students, and the district immediately sent the family a hotspot. But the larger challenges remain. And now, nearly 2 months into the remote learning, the district continues to face obstacles. For more on their efforts to support students, Rebecca Andrade, superintendent of the Salinas City Elementary School District, joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
To start, I want to check in on those two little girls. Have you and their teachers followed up with them since that photo went viral, and how are they doing?
Yes, absolutely. We connected with them that same day, and we have followed up through our Family Resource Center, as well as our school teachers and administrators, and met with the mom and provided additional support that they needed at that time. We have a really generous community and an incredibly well-stocked resource center that has everything from food, clothes, diapers, you name it, as well as resources if you are looking at transitional home or counseling services that you may be needing.
Here in California, 20% of students don't have internet access. How is your district navigating those challenges with remote learning?
As a district, we have provided hotspots, and I am saying that those are, in a sense, a Band-Aid, because there's a larger discussion that we need to have in terms of internet access in remote areas that may not have the ability to connect, no matter whether you have a hotspot or not.
Right, because this moment has really illuminated what has been a major problem for quite some time when it comes to broadband access and connectivity. Mm-hmm. Your district is also offering computer classes for parents to help their kids. Mm-hmm. How did you realize this need was there, and are parents able to come?
Yeah, and when I first came onto the district in July, the second week that I was here, we held a town hall meeting, a virtual town hall meeting, and it was very apparent that that was the biggest worry and concern from parents, recognizing that their children were going to continue to be at home, and how are we going to be accessing that service and that education. It's a challenge that I think we are all dealing with, but mm-hmm. In particularly with families that may not have been as used to having to go into these online platforms, that the learning curve is a little bit steeper. Mm-hmm. But I have to tell you, the other thing that we are doing for families as they need them is that in some instances, we also recognize that there may be a need for a student desk and a chair. And so we have started to actually check out student desks and chairs for families that are requesting them, so that they have the environment that our children and our students need to be able to feel that this is school time.
You know, Salinas is also known as the salad bowl of the world. Agricultural work, which is essential work, dominates work in that area. Are parents able to supervise students? What are some of the solutions available in that regard?
I would say that many of our families continue, if they are in the agricultural work, they are continuing to work. And one of the things and solutions that we are looking at is really bringing in the in-person small cohort for our students that are experiencing homelessness or are in the foster youth category, as well as our English learners and those in special needs.
Yes, I was going to ask you about English language learners. How is the district and ELL teachers handling this and ensuring that students receive this instruction in particular, which is normally so hands-on?
The biggest thing that we are seeing is the need for students to have more time in terms of student talk time. And that ratio is so much more limited in this environment. So what we are seeing is that students that are English learners, as well as our students that are in the Spanish immersion programs, are having a much more difficult time being able to feel a successful transition to this time.
Right. As you move forward and think about the rest of the year, what are some more direct things that you're thinking about in this moment to make certain that you can sustain what you're doing for the rest of possibly this school year?
Yeah. So we no longer need devices. We're talking about the issue of internet access. I think that the expansion of the connectivity is really something that I think is the next step for students, families, and the community at large.
Rebecca Andrade is superintendent of the Salinas City Elementary School District. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.